Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
This event is being recorded, so please take that into consideration if you choose to participate.
On August 16th, the Bureau of Reclamation, the part of the Interior Department that manages water in the western U.S., held a press conference online.
I'm honored to introduce the Assistant Secretary for Water and Science, Ms. Tanya Trujillo, to discuss 2022 operations.
The virtual press conference had all the stilted aesthetics of pandemic life. Government officials on video chat, long pauses, and awkward script reading.
Good afternoon. I'm Tanya Trujillo, the Assistant Secretary for Water and Science at the Department of the Interior.
Trujillo's monotone introduction didn't capture the gravity of what she was there to say. For the first time in the 99 years that the government has been keeping records, they were declaring a water shortage on the Colorado River, a river that 40 million Americans rely on.
We are seeing the effects of climate change in the Colorado River Basin through extended drought, extreme temperatures, expansive wildfires, and in some places, flooding and landslides. And now is the time to take action to respond to them.
Starting in January, farmers, ranchers, and irrigation districts will be forced to use less water. Arizona will be hit particularly hard. For people who've been watching the Colorado for years, like ProPublica reporter Abram Lusgarden, this shortage was entirely predictable.
Do you ever feel like Cassandra?
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I'd like to try to look around corners a little bit with what I'm hearing from the climate community and the environment community. And yeah, I get a bad rap for being the bearer of bad news.
Abram wrote a series of stories called Killing the Colorado that laid out the mistakes, policy choices, and human stubbornness that brought us to this point.
You know, on one hand, climate change's impacts on the river are surprising. They're coming faster, and they're having greater impact than some people expected. But on the other hand, the river's been in trouble for a long, long time, and that's not a surprise to the people that watch it closely.
Today on the show, Abram explains how we got here and whether there's a path forward out of this emergency. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, how the future will be determined. Stick with us.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
You know, I think if you're sitting on the East Coast or maybe in parts of the Midwest or in the South, you might not have a mental picture of the Colorado River and the Colorado River sort of ecosystem. Are there images in your head or things you think about that can help people kind of visualize what we're talking about?
I mean, I've been up and down the river, and it's a 1,400-mile system. You know, it goes from the high in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado all the way down to, you know, the Gulf of California and Mexico. I mean, the iconic images are the big dams, the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead outside of Las Vegas, and the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell in northern Arizona. And those are just desert landscapes of red rocks and cliffs lining this immense sort of pool of water. But then I lived in Colorado for a number of years, and the Colorado River there is a raging clear stream full of trout running through high mountains with snowmelt running into it through gorgeous meadows of green grasses. And it's really that kind of idyllic cliche of a big wild river.
I think one thing I have been struck by in your reporting is the vastness of who relies on this river system. Who depends on it?
So 40 million Americans, give or take, depend on water from the Colorado River. But that water is also used to irrigate farms that provide an incredible proportion of the fruits and vegetables that get shipped around the country, as well as feed for the cattle that is a really substantial portion of the meat consumed by Americans. So grocery store shelves on the East Coast packed with carrots and lettuce, very likely those vegetables were grown with Colorado River water. And the same with your meat and your hamburgers. In addition to that, the water is routed outside of the Colorado River Basin to, you know, the cities of Phoenix, the cities of Los Angeles and San Diego and Denver, none of which are in the natural geography of the Colorado River. Hmm.
I want to back up a little bit and understand kind of the foundations that were laid, frankly, 100 years ago for some of where we ended up now. And I'm talking about the legal framework for how the water would be used.
Yeah, so there's layers of laws that cover how the river is divided up. But the fundamental and the top layer one is this agreement that you're referring to between the seven states that share the Colorado River. And in this 1922 compact, they essentially used what data they had, which was really limited, to calculate how much water they thought would be flowing through the Colorado River on average, and took that amount and divided it proportionally amongst the seven of them.
So we're talking Arizona, California, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, right?
Yes. So they divided amongst them, not equally, but proportional to what they each agreed was their, you know, relative claim on the river. And they proceeded forward for the next 100 years, never really changing that amount, even as the data improved. And you could see over a greater period of time that the river's flow was actually substantially less.
I think that's one of the things that is so head-scratching to me is that, you know, this agreement that was drawn up in 1922 hasn't really been changed.
Yeah, there's been talk of changing it off and on over those years. In 2007, these same parties came together and reached an agreement about what they would do if there ever was, a serious shortage on the river. So they agreed that they would each absorb some cuts, and they didn't really specify what those cuts would be. But it wasn't until 2019 that they actually reached a third agreement, which specified exactly how much water Arizona would lose when we have a shortage declaration, and how much California would lose, and so forth. But these are kind of adjustments still to that 1922 compact. They don't fundamentally change that compact. And if the river's flow were to increase again in the future, these states would still revert back to that larger amount of water that they agreed 100 years ago that they would each receive.
The problem's complicated. The 1922 compact overestimated how much water was in the river system to begin with. And now, of course, there's even less. On top of that, the rules about divvying up the water, whether you're a city, an irrigation district, or a rancher, essentially operate like dibs or calling shotgun in a car.
The phrase that people like to use in the West is first in time, first in right. And what that essentially means is the people or the water users who arrived in these places where the water is used first and claimed the water when they got there hold the most senior water rights, and their water rights remain senior no matter who comes after them. And those senior water rights trump junior water rights even to this day, with an exception. The law says that if you don't use those senior water rights to their full extent every year, then they could be confiscated and given to somebody with more junior water rights. And so what happens across many parts of the upper basin, in my reporting, when I was talking to ranchers in Colorado and Wyoming, for example, is that even if they don't need all of the water they're allowed to take in a given year, they take it all anyway, and they dump it out so that from a legal basis, they can tell the state that they take their water every single year, and they don't risk losing their rights. So you multiply that by thousands and thousands of water users, and you have a pretty extraordinary inefficiency right there.
Why has this almost frontier mindset survived to 2021 in the way we think about and legislate water?
Part of it is cultural. The culture of the West survives. In the North, in the mountains, it's a culture of rugged individualism. And in the South, it is still a bit individualistic and conservative. And you couple that with this sort of seniority nature of water rights, and the rights to the water track to the history of the place, not to how it has evolved in more modern times. I mean, a perfect example of that is that cities didn't exist in the mid-1800s, and so they have very junior water rights now, even though that's where most of the people are. So literally, the largest volume of water goes to the people in places with the deepest historical roots.
Add to that unprecedented drought for two decades, plus losing water to evaporation and leaky old infrastructure. It doesn't look like the shortage the government declared last month is going away anytime soon.
What's most significant to me when I look at, the shortage declaration in August is that it also came with a forecast for what the Federal Bureau of Reclamation expects the future water levels to be. And they forecast a significant possibility of very, very severe shortages and further drops in Lake Mead by the middle of 2023. And that would force an entirely new negotiation that would basically put the river system outside of the sphere that the seven states have so far considered a new paradigm of shortage, if you will. And it's really unclear what happens next.
When we come back, can seven states, 29 federally recognized tribes, and part of Mexico, everybody who gets water from the Colorado, set aside self-interest and try to work together?
What is the one most important thing our society needs?
That would be harsher punishment for parole violators, Stan. And world peace.
Okay, we get it. World peace might seem like a pipe dream. But what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
What comes to mind when you think of Amber Heard? A liar? A survivor? A narcissist? The trial of Depp v. Heard was a global phenomenon, but I want to know, was it a fair fight? I'm Alexi Mostras, the host of Sweet Bobby and Hoaxed. In my new podcast, I'm investigating whether Amber Heard was the victim of an organized trolling campaign. The entire series is now available to binge wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Who Trolled Amber.
You're listening to What Next TBD. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and I'm talking with Abram Lustgarten from ProPublica about the water shortage on the Colorado River.
You talked a little bit about the negotiations between these different states and stakeholders. What are those potentially going to look like? And I guess I wonder who has the most power in these negotiations.
So California is a huge player. It uses something like a third of the river, and it uses most of its water rights to grow those fruits and vegetables in Southern California in the Imperial Valley. For a lot of really complicated reasons, and partially because California is that entity that holds the most leverage and the most power, California has largely shielded itself from some of the cutbacks that we're starting to see now. It's done that historically, and it's managed to kind of perpetuate that into the present moment. That makes California a real powerhouse going into negotiations going forward, but it also puts California kind of in the crosshairs. I think, you know, Nevada and Arizona in particular, but also the upper basin northern states have all made really significant sacrifices. They've bled, so to speak, through these processes. And I think that they all hope and believe that it's time for California to feel more of that pain. So, you know, a lot of these future discussions, I think, while nothing certain, are really going to focus on California.
You're making me think of an anecdote in a story you wrote in 2015 of a tunnel that Las Vegas built basically to tunnel down to water to look out for itself. Are there incentives for these seven states and the cities there to work together, or are there just power struggles?
It's a little bit of both. You know, the incentive to work together is that, you know, should any one party completely decimate this resource, all parties lose out. Everybody needs the water, and they have a mutual beneficial interest in preserving that water. But ultimately, these are separate power centers with their separate individual constituencies that they have to serve. And that's what the Las Vegas example tells us. It's a classic example. The water levels of Lake Mead are dropping. And as they drop past certain thresholds, the river and the infrastructure there will no longer be able to provide water and power to all of the people who share that resource. It will literally drop to a level that means that it cannot flow past the Hoover Dam, and it cannot make it to California or Arizona downstream. But what Las Vegas did is basically said, should that ever happen, we're going to have another way out. And they built what amounts to a drain hole in the bottom of the lake. They built their own pipeline that comes in at a lower level and gives the city of Las Vegas a way to continue to remove water only for itself from Lake Mead should it no longer be able to flow to Arizona and California downstream.
I think like a lot of climate change related problems, this can feel really intractable. If you're just a person listening and thinking like, I don't want to be a part of this, but I don't know how to do anything that makes a difference on the margins. Are there things that an individual can do?
Well, here's one that's, you know, that I wrote about in my story, and this is perhaps far-fetched to some, but because of how much water is used to grow alfalfa, to feed cattle, to provide meat, the research suggests that if Americans stopped eating meat just one day a week, you know, sort of a meatless Mondays kind of thing, that alone would translate to a savings of water equivalent to the entire flow of the river. You know, were that ever to happen, that would solve the West's water problems in its entirety for a long time to come.
You know, I started this interview by asking you if you felt like a Cassandra, and I guess I wonder, as someone who's been reporting on this for a long time, like, do you ever feel hopeful or do you just feel depressed?
Well, you know, it's I report on all things climate, and it becomes difficult to separate the water scarcity issues in the Colorado River Basin from water scarcity issues across the country from all of the other really significant impacts that we're seeing from climate change. And in the context of the big picture, it's hard to stay hopeful. But when you drill down into specific issues, I think there's lots to be done and that can still make a big difference, whether that's, you know, reducing emissions, which still presents an enormous opportunity to make the pain that we're all going to experience in the future a lot less impactful. But also in terms of water usage itself, you know, I look at the Colorado River Basin and there's a lot of water still to work with. And there's so much inefficiency that I think that there is enormous opportunity to recalibrate how that water is used and make it last a whole lot longer without having the kind of devastating impacts on people's lives in that region that many people are afraid of now.
Abram Lustgarten, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Abram Lustgarten is a senior investigative reporter at ProPublica. All right, that is it for us today. TBD is produced by Ethan Brooks, and we're edited by Tori Bosch and Allison Benedict. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer for Slate Podcasts. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and it's also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And I cannot recommend strongly enough that you go back and listen to Thursday's episode of What Next. Slate's Ayman Ismail talks about what it was like to grow up as an American Muslim in the shadow of 9/11. What Next? We'll be back next week. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.